Next speaker is Cormac Swap.
Well, for thousands of years, mankind has been improving its ability to survive comfortably within nature. And we can now safely say that in the 20th century, we have finally developed technology to feed, clothe, and house and satisfy the needs of the whole of humanity. But at the same time, on every side, you see social problems which are plaguing humanity, whether it's housing, hunger, pollution, poverty, or war. Take one example. At the moment, you have 20 or 30 million people every single year who are dying from malnutrition or from malnutrition-related diseases. That's the equivalent of about one person each second. And yet, at the same time, you have the United Nations reporting back in 1970, and I quote, "The surface of the Earth has hardly been scratched." And in September 1976, the Scientific American quoted a couple of reputable scientists, Loomis and Hopper, who demonstrated that the Earth, in fact, has the potential to feed as much as 12 times the present population. Now, these contradictions between what we could do technologically and what society would allow us to do, these contradictions can only be explained in one way. The fact is, we have a social system which is getting in our way. It's out of line with modern technology, and it actually prevents that modern technology from being used to satisfy basic human needs. That social system, we call it capitalism, it doesn't matter what it's called, it's a social system which dominates the globe and has as its first priority profitable sales in the marketplace rather than serving useful human needs. Now, having said all of that, and having heard what the other speakers have said, we can surmise that a number of people, perhaps millions of people, would hear this and say, yes, we agree, we've got to get rid of this social system, and we've got to have a different social system in its place which would allow us to satisfy human needs. That's fair enough. The question is how? What do you actually do? Now, I would argue that there are basically two policies, no more, which are currently competing for the support of these millions of people who are discontented, many of us obviously amongst those people. Now, this discontent is quite obvious, but which of those two policies you choose to adopt is perhaps not quite so obvious. On the one hand, you have the policy of reformism. In other words, you try to patch up the social framework, you try to rearrange the social furniture, you try to solve these problems one by one. You try to modify society bit by bit, piecemeal. Now, reformism as a policy, which is adopted very almost universally at the moment, it's a very popular policy, but one which succeeds time and time again in proving a complete failure. The reason for this is that reformism is trying to work against the trend of history instead of with it. What reformism is trying to do is to turn the clock back. It's trying to humanise a system which is in fact getting more and more anti-human. In that sense, it's going against the historical trends of capitalism. It's trying to modify what cannot be modified. And in that sense, any of the apparent gains which reformism makes, the occasional concessions which are won from the ruling elite, these gains are grasped in spite of, rather than because of, this policy. They're flukes, in other words, when they appear to come. Now, on the other hand, you have the policy of revolutionary socialism, as I'll go on to describe it, which is the only movement which is, in fact, in line with historical development. It actually sees the problems for what they are, intractable social problems which can only be solved by bringing social relationships into line with modern technology, totally transforming the way society is run. Now, to illustrate the difference between these two policies, I'm going to take a few quick examples. And we'll start with the obvious example of unemployment. Now, in the reformist camp on unemployment, you have two main groups who are competing with one another, both reformist. On the one hand, you have the Keynesians, the SDP, most of the Labour Party, and so on, who say that if you boost government spending, that will somehow solve the unemployment problem. Now, what these people don't often mention is the fact that between 1973 and 1980, government spending in this country effectively quadrupled from £20 to £80 billion per year in cash terms. So they did, in fact, boost government spending during that period. And, of course, during those 10 years or so, unemployment, far from reducing, multiplied several times over. So the Keynesian policy has been tried and it's failed. On the other hand, you have the other gang of reformists who are simply advocating the opposite reform. You have the monetarists, the Tories, the Friedmanites, who are saying that what you should do is cut back vigorously on government spending, don't boost the economy, try to be sparing about it, and that will solve the problems. Again, what they don't mention is that between the two wars, you had no inflation of the currency to speak of, you had no boosting of government spending in that way. Indeed, one might say that throughout the 19th century, you had these monetarist policies of a kind, and of course what happened was that you had mass unemployment on many occasions. So both of these reformist camps, this sort of double act of saying spend more or spend less, they are following a reformist policy and it doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is because the capitalist system they're dealing with is uncontrollable and it's unpredictable. Take, for example, the following quotation from the Evening Standard. "The recession is coming to an end, and recovery is on the way. That is the conclusion today of a survey by the London Chamber of Commerce and Industry." The date of the report? The 10th of August, 1981. That's how predictable and how successful capitalism can be run in that way. Now, on the other hand, the revolutionary policy about unemployment is that the only way you can solve unemployment is to get rid of the whole system of employment itself, and to replace it with a harmonious system of voluntary cooperation in which people can work to satisfy human needs instead of working to satisfy the needs of the marketplace with all of their tragic fluctuations. Second example, health, very important to us all. Now, a couple of months ago in the Mail on Sunday, the following was stated. Norman Tebbit, Trade and Industry Secretary, wants to put a cash value on life. He wants, quote, "an acceptable value for each life saved," close quote, worked out so that he can decide whether it is worth forcing firms to improve the safety of their products. So this is the Tory message. Put a price on every life, and if it's not worth it, let them die. Now, Guy's Hospital opened heart unit over the past few months. Six doctors who had performed as many as 712 open heart operations during the course of the previous year, which was 50 more than their official quota, were told that they had been saving too many lives in terms of the cash available, and therefore they were forced to freeze all future life-saving work for the past two or three months of the financial year just ended. Once April came round, fair enough, it's a new financial year, but during March and April and February, they were told, no, you must call a halt to saving lives because the cash is not, in fact, there. Who were they forced into this by? Well, by the District Health Authority of Lewisham and North Southwark, under a Labour-controlled council, a Labour Party having constantly claimed that, unlike the Tories, they stood for something completely different. And there they are, in office, in power, implementing that has to be called murder of people who couldn't afford to go into the private sector and have their heart surgery. And it's worth stating that during the last Labour government, there were public spending cuts in 1976 and 7 of 2.8% a year, and in 1977 to 8, 6.3% per year. Now, the revolutionary approach to healthcare, you don't measure lives in terms of pounds or pence, you look at the human resources available, the doctors themselves, and you have them saving lives. You have free access to healthcare in a socialist society, with the emphasis on prevention rather than upon cure. Resources would be liberated for healthcare by the removal of this absurd need to show cash balances in relation to human lives. Thirdly, let's move on to the equally important example of housing. Now, every single government for the past 100 years has promised, without exception, to do something about the housing crisis, which has continued non-stop during that period. The problem, the shortage, the chronic state of housing in this country. But in 1985, after 100 years of promises by politicians, there are today less houses being built than at any other time since the Second World War, despite a brick surplus on the one hand, despite 500,000 unemployed building workers on the other hand, and in spite of the fact that you have over 50,000 homeless families in this country today who need houses built for them. Well, of course, there are over 600,000 empty homes, but these are not currently accessible to those homeless people because these are the second, third or fourth homes of the rich, or in some cases, the raw material of the games played by the speculators. Now, bodies like Shack or Shelter have admitted recently their helplessness in face of these problems, but a socialist society can solve them. On the basis of the common ownership of productive resources, we can build houses for people to live in without asking ourselves, will it make a profit for the construction firms if we do so? Now, I mentioned the Labour Party, and so have one or two of the other speakers. What is the Labour Party response to socialism as we stand for it? Let's be quite clear about this. The Labour Party doesn't simply fail to make the revolutionary grade. The Labour Party is, in fact, vehemently anti-socialist in its real practice. It is an anti-socialist body which stands in the way of progress in the socialist movement. The Labour Coordinating Committee's document on the AES, the Alternative Economic Strategy, talks about socialism as follows. Production only creates jobs if the products can be sold. Production for use is nothing more than a romantic fantasy unless there is some way of transforming social needs into effective demand. The old capitalist argument that it's got to be cash demand, not human demand. And as for Neil Kinnock, he was on television recently and he said, I want the government to govern. I wish they would start to do it and then the country would be in a much better situation. If they can't do it, they should shift aside and let us get on with it. We'll lead and we'll govern. That was Kinnock on Newsnight, and you see that he's itching to get his fingers on the reins of social power in order to administer the capitalist system. Now, finally, and perhaps most importantly, we move on to the question of war. Because if there's ever a case for reforming things, it's to try to reform out of existence the threat which is over all of our heads right now. That before this year is out, we might not be here. There could be a war which will finish us all off. Now, the obvious movement which is appealing to discontented workers is CND, the broad church which campaigns against the weapons of war. It doesn't campaign against war itself or against the root cause of war, but simply against the tools which are used to fight wars. And that's its first problem. Now, CND claims over 100,000 members, 115,000 to be exact, and they claim 400,000 active supporters, nearly 500,000. And in spite of those vast numbers of support, they have completely failed to have any effect whatsoever over the past 5 years on the arms race or the stockpiling of arms. Completely failed. Now, the reason for this, to be quite clear about it, is that their approach is based on the idea that you can moralise about the horror of nuclear weapons without needing to formulate a practical alternative to that, which is based on social transformation. Some kind of real change, instead of simply trying to plead with the government to use weapon A instead of weapon B. A waste of time. Now, there was a failure, as you know, to stop the sighting of cruise missiles at Greenham, and indeed, the Greenham Common missiles have now been made fully operational. Now, last month, there was a CND demonstration taking place at Molesworth, because in 1988, the next set of cruise missiles are due to arrive at Molesworth. Now, this CND demo was reported upon, and finally, the demonstrators had gathered around the barbed wire, which was the perimeter fence, and there was a load of police inside. There's no other missiles there because they're not due till 1988, so you can imagine the spectacle. Police inside, demonstrators outside. And after a lot of fuss, one of these demonstrators broke through the fence, broke through the barbed wire, and ran into the middle of the camp. What happened, of course? He ran straight into the arms of about half a dozen policemen and was carried away. That was the end of his gesture. Now, I don't mean to ridicule people who are clearly sincere and are trying to do something. But let's be frank about it. That was pretty futile. And it goes further than that. The culmination of the demonstration, as organised by CND, was a plan, and I quote, to ring the base with sound. Now, everybody present was instructed by CND to pin a photograph of themselves on the wire and to make as much noise as they possibly could using football rattles, whistles, bells and drums, to make such a noise that it even drowned out the sound of the military helicopters which were buzzing around overhead. And they did that. The noise was made. Well, I would like to say, without being unduly cynical, that that seems very interesting, very good theatre, very theatrical. But what about results in terms of saving our skins from this kind of calamity? It's not very sensible. And in fact, the chairwoman of CND, Joan Ruddock, was quoted as follows. She said, "The events this weekend really marked the beginning of our struggle to prevent cruise missiles being sighted at the base. It is the first major demonstration and the beginning of our pledge for people from all over Britain to come and make a constant witness and protest around the perimeter of this base. We intend to do that," she says. "We intend to do that until such time that cruise missiles are not deployed, or should they be deployed, we are here to protest until they are taken away." Now, what she's saying there is really an admission of defeat before the campaign has even begun. because the implication is that in 1988 they will still be making that noise. The missiles will arrive just like they arrived at Greenham, and then they'll carry on making the noise in the hope they might go away. Now, the fact that 60 to 70% of people have replied to opinion polls saying that they're against the sighting of Cruise and Trident obviously makes no difference. The Tory government shows no signs of allowing that to deter them in their course. You might be therefore forgiven for thinking that if you push towards an alternative government, perhaps Labour government in power within capitalism, that they will listen to that 60 or 70%. But the fact of the matter is that experience shows us that the pledges of somebody like Neil Kinnock really aren't worth the paper which they're written on. As the Labour defence spokesman Denzil Davis was quoted recently as saying, the Labour Party, he said, is totally committed to the defence of Britain. And no doubt those are the kind of phrases which would be used to justify the situation if and when a Labour government started to build up its own nuclear weapons, just as it did when the Polaris weapons were introduced by the last Labour government in such secrecy that even the Labour Party's own MPs didn't know that those nuclear weapons were being introduced. Now, I think it's quite clear from all of that that reform policies on these issues are insufficient. When it comes to an issue as profoundly disturbing as war, we have to look at the root causes, and the other speakers have done that. The fact is that wars arise in the capitalist modern world because of the rivalry between capitalist trading nations over issues which concern the capitalist class, not ourselves. They're fighting wars over issues of controlling markets, trade routes, and raw materials, which most of us have no interest in at all. So what do we want to see as a socialist movement? What is it we're talking about? There can be no socialism, there can be no society of common ownership and free access to wealth without first having a majority of socialists. And that's what we're fighting for. Now, workers, the working class like ourselves, are the only part of the productive forces in society which is living. Workers, therefore, must organise together as the greatest active expression of the machinery of modern industry. We are the living parts of modern industry. And we can express the need to expand that production, the need to put that machinery into motion in order to satisfy human needs. And what sort of movement must this be? It must pay full attention to the great strength, the unbeatable strength of democracy and of consciousness and awareness amongst the movement itself. In other words, we want a political movement in which people don't follow leaders, they think for themselves, they understand what they want and how to get it. We're talking about a movement in which debate, persuasion, struggle through democratic channels are what it's all about. And that has to be coupled, as has been suggested, with a vital element of vision. There is a socialist alternative. It can be made practical. And it's the duty of the socialist movement to constantly make that vision quite visible and quite clear in front of one another. And in order to do that, we can look at capitalism, we can see what its basis is, and we can erect in our movement the alternative basis to be put in place of it. So society will be transformed by people understanding the present capitalist system and desiring socialism as a practical alternative. The only sure route towards this is that which was summed up in one of the earliest slogans of the socialist movement, no compromise. In the words of the first Socialist Party manifesto, first published nearly 80 years ago, to change society, workers must, and I quote, give up the superstition that the robbers can be friendly to the robbed. The class struggle, in other words, will only end with the democratic dispossession of the employing class by the rest of us, the vast majority. We have to organise together in order to take over and dismantle all of the oppressive machinery of the state. Well, I'd like to finish, if I may, this meeting on the abolition of the wages system or the profit system by quoting from D.H. Lawrence, who wrote on the subject of wages as follows. He says, earning a wage is a prison occupation, and a wage earner is a sort of jailbird. Earning a salary is a prison overseer's job, a jailer instead of a jailbird. Living on your income is strolling grandly outside the prison in terror lest you have to go in. And since the work prison covers almost every scrap of the living earth, you stroll up and down on a narrow beat, about the same as a prisoner taking his exercise. This is called universal freedom.